All right, this is Paige Stewart interviewing Ian Pringle for the 30th anniversary. Ian, can you tell me about your role at CKUT around 1987?
Well, let's see. I actually started with the station before it went FM, when it was really still, I guess, Radio McGill, and it was on cable. And I was introduced to the station because I was working with the McGill Tribune and did a feature story on the radio station because the CRTC had just approved its license. And so that was my first introduction to the station, was doing researching this story for one of the papers. And I was just fascinated from the moment that I walked in. I was like, this is the most exciting thing ever. And what a fun place. And as it turned out, I had just finished my first year at McGill and really wanted to stay in Montreal. And so the station was looking for a bookkeeper, and I had some experience as a bookkeeper. So I actually spent that first summer, which would have been 1987, as the station's bookkeeper. And by that point, I kind of got hooked on the more interesting side of the station, and then transitioned into doing, I guess, what we called at the time, maybe we still do, is spoken word programming.
So you were more on the news side then?
Well, more on community programming, and I guess news was a part of it. When I think back on it, I think the most interesting parts for me were, yeah, I guess the news, current affairs, and also the really strong priority that CKUT had placed on community involvement as part of its proposal to the CRTC. And as I understand it, it was really why CKUT was granted the license, when everybody thought that Concordia would be the station that would get the license. CKUT really surprised everybody, and it was because of the quality of the application. And a big part of that was the emphasis that was placed on community participation, community involvement in the station.
Yeah, there has been some myths floating around about kind of some sort of rivalry happening between CKUT and, or I guess Radio McGill and Concordia, trying to get the English license.
Oh, big time.
So those details are cool. Do you want to speak a little more about the rivalry? Were words ever said?
I'm sure they were. All what I really remember was that it was a surprise. I think that my impression is the story went at the time that folks at Concordia had a much better established station. They were linked to a much stronger communication program within the university. And that the assumption really was, based on those factors, that Concordia was the natural, would be the natural recipient. But what people didn't really count on so much was that CKUT's application was a superb application. CKUT and the people that wrote it, Martha Marie Kleinhans, and other people who were behind that application, I mean, they mobilized a really strong team to put it together, and they really understood what the commission wanted. So in the end, I don't think it was much of a surprise when you really looked at the process. But I don't remember any, there were no throwdown fights or anything quite so dramatic, but it was a big surprise to people, and pretty sure the Concordia Radio folks were pretty pissed off.
Yeah. You can move on. What is your earliest memory at CKUT?
Well, certainly I remember the space, and the space was quite something, down in the basement, and a little bit of a labyrinth, and you kind of went deeper and deeper and deeper, as you got into it, and finally sort of culminating in the studios in the back. One of the things I remember, I'm not sure whether it's the earliest memory, but one of the things that really stands out for me were the kind of processes that happened at the station, the debates and the meetings and the station was about to go on air. There were a lot of things that needed to be worked out. And so people had very strong opinions and were very passionate about it. So I remember meetings, like in the hallways. There was a space at the kind of at the end where, there were emergency doors. So we, outside of the doors of the station, there was kind of this dead end space in the hallway, which became like an impromptu, unofficial meeting space, like a boardroom almost, or a a committee room for the station. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of these meetings happen, just people sitting around on the floor and debating, and for the most part, very respectful and productive debates, but they got pretty heated, at times. It was a very passionate place, and it was, when I think back on it, it was a real kind of confluence of people, like really different people who were coming together around these ideas of, freedom of expression, and whether that was music and the kind of music that people were playing. And I know that CKUT is still a real, it's a definer. It's a group that defines partly, music spaces, what's new, what's cool. But it was the same thing on the community side too, where there were feminists and gay people and lesbians and people of color. And there was a lot of really dynamic space, or really dynamic people coming into that space. So lots of good debates. That's what I really remember.
These impromptu meetings, were they mostly just with staff, or were they with programmers as well?
Staff and volunteers. From the time that I arrived there, a very strong group of people who were very committed and people who had been at the station for quite a while the station had been on closed circuit, which was like broadcasting to the university on kind of cables and whatnot, and then on cable itself, FM cable. The first couple of years, when I think about it, the first couple of years at the station, there were really no staff. You had lots of volunteers, often who were working, long hours and very, very dedicated, but then also people who were paid, honorarium. So maybe they'd get $1,000 or a couple of $1,000 for their contributions over the course of a year, which made it a little bit easier for them to devote that kind of time and maybe not get another job. So I guess it was a bit of a gray area between programmers, staff, volunteers. I have one other memory, actually, which is that testing the transmitter, because one of the big things is after the license had been granted, we had to make sure that the signal wouldn't interfere with other broadcasters. So there was a technical element to it that had to be cleared. Mm-hmm. And it was a bit nerve-wracking because this was something that was clearly beyond anybody's control. It was really a question of whether or not we could operate successfully on that frequency. And I do remember, when we first tested the transmitter had been installed and driving around, tuning in the station at 90.3. to see how strong the signal was and whatnot. And it was probably music that might not actually have been allowed on the station later on, but mm-hmm. During the test broadcast, I guess it was okay. It was a very exciting time. That's, I think, there was an emotion I remember around it. It was real excitement and real passion. And I think, for me personally, it's something that has always stuck with me, that's what I sort of crave in a work environment and in a space that you're going to be involved in, is you want it to be exciting and you really want people to be passionate about it. It was a remarkably inclusive space. There were so many different types of people who were coming into that space for different reasons. But for the most part, it was somehow something that could accommodate a pretty wide range of people. And looking back on it, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, definitely. It's still totally amazing in that way. You also kind of just answered my next question, which is, did you have a vision for CKUT?
I really think that was the vision. I mean, mm-hmm. What motivated me, really, really strongly were these ideas around community inclusion and the fact that this was a space in which it was a unique space. There was nowhere else like it that could provide this kind of a space. Again, whether it was a space for musicians and artists, or whether it was a space for groups in the community that had absolutely nowhere else where they could broadcast on their own terms and communicate on their own terms. And, at the time I had come out in certain kinds of circles, with my family and with some of my close friends, but it was also an opportunity for me as a gay man to come out, in a much bigger space. And to not only be accepted, but also that it was part of what the station did was to give a voice to different communities, a voice and a place to listen. So that was definitely my vision. And it had a huge impact on me in the sense that that's all I've really ever done. I still work in radio, and the kind of radio that I still work in is really around providing an opportunity for marginalized groups to have a information, communication, learning, expression service. And it formed at that time. I mean, it was a remarkable time and a pretty remarkable group of people.
Yeah, totally. That was actually another one of my questions. It was, how did your experience at CKUT inform your future endeavors and prospects? Do you want to say a little bit more about what you do now?
Well, CKUT was what I can remember thinking at the time, that what I always really wanted to do was to work in media and to be in an environment where it was really about people, and that the station really provided that. And so it was incredibly exciting. And it really, for me, it really launched not only a professional career, but also a kind of a way of thinking and an approach. So even in the times when I worked less in radio and maybe more in other media, it was still around those same ideas, not so much around journalism or broadcasting, mainstream broadcasting, but always communication as a form of social activism and as a form of community building.
Mm-hmm.
So working for CKUT, I went on to work for Co-op Radio in Vancouver, which is also a really fascinating experience. And it was a little bit like the work I did at CKUT. It was more on the community building and the kind of public affairs side, and really the right to communicate those kind of ideological elements. And those two things set me up to work internationally. So I've spent the last, well, I guess, 20 years, working in international communications with Canadian international organizations, and then the UN and a Commonwealth agency. And now I work for a group called Farm Radio International. So the thread, in a sense, is really very much the same around the role that the potential of a communication medium like radio to be a community builder and a vehicle for social development, in mm-hmm. a sense, whatever that development might be, but very much around the participation of people in communication, in public medium, so in public and community spaces.
Tell me a little bit about some of your coworkers that you had over the years. And
two people who I remember from the very early days of CKUT,
mm-hmm.
And that was David Shannon.
Oops. Mm-hmm.
And Don Rossiter. And Don was the spoken word coordinator when I arrived. And I guess I actually took over from him when he left.
Mm-hmm.
And David was the host of a program called The Homo Show,
mm-hmm.
which was the precursor to QueerCore.
Cool.
And they were both really, pretty remarkable individuals. Unfortunately, both have died. And both were real voices for the gay community. David much more kind of publicly so, but Donnie in a very powerful way in his own right. And they were incredibly close friends. And they were a big, big reason why the station was a comfortable and a welcoming place to somebody like me.
Mm-hmm.
And a big motivator to get involved, and really helped sort of launch me on a pathway of being more involved in the station and me feeling like that was a good place for me to be. I remember very well a woman named Lisa Weinbaum, mm-hmm. who was also involved in spoken word programming and a real strong kind of political voice. I mean, it was a great place to get a political education as a young person in terms of politics around race and politics around gender and politics around sexuality in particular. Certainly Nadine Gelinot, she was a really powerful person, incredibly talented person. Yeah, I mean, those are really, some of the people that stand out for me. Chris McGone,
mm-hmm.
Who... at one point, I always remember being really surprised because Chris was the music director. And then when a job came up to be the production manager, he applied for the job. And I can remember being really surprised that he would go from sort of music. And he was also a sound artist, and he did a program on sound, art. But his his role was really more around music. And I always remember being very surprised when he applied for the job that he wanted to be the production manager. But it was, I think, probably one of the most significant things that happened at CKUT, because he really brought a sound art and an incredibly creative and really wacky, very different sound to the station. And, you know, when I tune into CKUT today, I can still hear that sound. And it was really Chris McGone, in my opinion, who really introduced that sound. Not to say the station didn't have a creative sound before, but I remember when I worked in Nepal, you know, saying to the staff there and trying to communicate a little bit, and even playing some of the jingles and the ads and the promos that came from CKUT, because it wasn't just one. It became, in a sense, the sound of the station, that it was really, really creative and very, very different than any other radio station that you'd hear, you know, in Montreal. And in a sense, I think almost as different as any station I've ever heard. So all those people had a really profound impact. You know, Lisa Weinbaum, in terms of how passionate the station would be about ensuring that it was a space for marginalized communities. And that was something that we were really going to fight for. Mm-hmm. And that we were going to be radical. I remember Don Roster saying to me when, you know, I took over as the spoken word coordinator, giving me advice and saying, you know what, the station has to be on the edge. If we're going to be relevant, we have to be on the edge. We have to be on the cutting edge of politics, of culture, of anything. There's no point in us being mainstream. The only space that we're really going to be able to successfully occupy is going to be that really cutting edge space. And I think that the sort of tone that people set around that, I think has probably stood the station in really good stead, you know, over the years. Not to say that people who followed didn't make their own contributions, but I think a lot of those people like David and Don, and I don't comment so much on the folks who were in the music, but I remember the, you know, all those music directors from kind of early years that were so passionate about how important it was that we would play local music. And it wasn't so much around the CRTC's Canadian content rules. It was around the station's own policies and rules around promoting local talent. And people were so passionate about it. They were almost, you know, militants, kind of activists about all of this stuff that, I just remember always being so impressed by all these people, and so inspired by them. So I guess I hope I haven't forgotten anybody. I mean, even from the very early days, you know, somebody like Martha Marie Kleinhans, I think she was a bit of a controversial figure in the station for sure. But I don't think CKUT would exist without Martha. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that I can say that the station wouldn't exist if it hadn't been for her real passion and her force of personality. She's a real force of nature.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you so much for all of those descriptions. Have you heard of the term safe space?
You know, it's funny because when I was saying before about the fact that CKUT for me was a very inclusive space, the other thing that opened up for me, and I think the only space where I've ever felt as comfortable and as safe as the radio station, would be, you know, kind of the old school gay bars, where you really felt this was a space where anybody could come in here and anybody be safe, and people would lay down their lives to make sure that they could say that.
Some people have talked about that a little bit, how it's a safe space now for sure. Like no harassment of any kind is tolerated. But back then, some people say that it wasn't like a safe space because you were all gonna fight as hard as you possibly could to get the things that needed to get out there. Like you were like gonna be active and not worry about your safety. But it's really nice to hear that the culture with the people who were here often was really inclusive. And
yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I have to recognize the fact that it's probably easy for me to say that, you know, as a white man, and you know, all the other privileges that I enjoy, that for me it was a safe space.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly as a, you know, a gay man in the 1980s, albeit a, you know, white middle-class gay man, the station was a very safe place for me. Mm-hmm. And it certainly was a safe place for other people. And I, you know, I hope that the passion that people had didn't make it a less safe space for anybody else. Looking back on it, I think it might have. And I think we probably had blinders on a lot of the time. And we're so convinced of kind of that we were right and that we were fighting the good fight that maybe it didn't make it such a safe space for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe just not as inclusive.
Yeah, I think that, people who have said that, I think, were also like, they weren't saying it as a negative thing at all. They were just kind of commenting on how the term has evolved over time.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you remember Louise?
Burns?
Yeah.
Of course.
Okay. She asked me to ask you about Sex Garage.
It's also interesting. I mean, Louise is also a great person, and I know she stayed at the station for such a long time that, you know, she became one of those real pillars of the station. Well, you know, it's interesting because just recently I did another interview with somebody really reminiscing about David Shannon and the early days of queer journalism and, you know, queer media.
Mm-hmm.
So it brought back a lot of that. And, you know, before Sex Garage, there was also Gay Day. And, you know, it was a real, moment in time. And I think it was something really unique that CKUT did. It was in the aftermath of the murder of Joe Rose, who was a gay man who was murdered on a bus in Montreal. And the station's response, for the first time in its, you know, history, and maybe the first time that we certainly had never heard of anybody else doing that. So the idea was inspired from a need and from people's ideas, not thinking, oh, we could do this like somebody else had done. And it was to put on a full day of programming that was only about the gay community. And it was really only about, you know, the queer community coming in and doing the programming.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a whole day. And it really, in a sense, for me, set the tone of the station as being a real voice and sort of a vanguard of, you know, gay and lesbian activism in Montreal at the time, and recognizing that there was a real need for it and that the station could play a very positive role. And, you know, after Gay Day, we did a whole series of incredibly avant-garde safe sex PSAs that were very controversial. And it was huge debate within the station about the approach that we should take and the sound of these things and the scripts and everything else. And an enormous amount of energy went into it. And they were really very graphic. And we really took a big, big risk in terms of the language that was used and the descriptions that were used.
Mm-hmm.
But it was people weren't going to back down, you know, on that. Lisa Weinbaum was one of the kind of key drivers behind that whole piece of work, which I still think both of those things, Gay Day and all of those safe sex PSAs, were they were really unique. They were, I think it was a major, it was a big chance that the station took, but I think it was quite remarkable what the station did with those. And I was around during the, you know, the Sex Garage work. To be honest, it's funny. I don't remember it so much in the context of the radio station as I do in the context of the gay community in Montreal. But I was one of the people who was at that party and was arrested the night of the party and spent the night in jail and was subsequently charged with assault. So ironically, this is explained to me by the guy who was my lawyer, that what happens is that when the police are afraid that you'll charge them with assault, they charge you with assault.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's such a serious crime that the chances that you'll fight it are very, very limited. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. They charged me with assault of a police officer, which is a criminal offense. And so I plea bargained. But they were all wrapped up. I mean, for me, it was, you know, they were all kind of part of the same, you know, the same fight.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, Sex Garage, you know, there was a night at a party. I don't know if you know the whole story, but,
I don't know the
whole
story.
There was a standoff with the police on the night of this party, and a real standoff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a whole line of police officers who all took off their badges and put on rubber gloves and then assaulted people with, you know, billy clubs and just beat them up.
Wow.
And it set off, you know, a month of a very intensive protest, one of which resulted in about 50 arrests and, you know, just the most obscene abuse of power on behalf of the police, all, you know, well documented and, you know, brazenly done in public. The
mm-hmm.
kind of degree of public homophobia was matched only by the degree of public, you know, and police racism around, you know, Mohawks and Ganesatagi and Ganawaki and the whole Oakland crisis, which was happening at exactly the same time.
Wow, yeah.
And you know, I think, you know, when I look back on it, I don't remember so much around the radio station, but I know that the radio station had everybody's back. I mean, it was one media outlet that was, you were never going to couch anything in terms of, oh, well, we should have both sides of the story or... you know, it was a human rights issue and the station was always, you know, out there, you know, fighting that fight. And there was no, there were no gray areas. There was no sort of deliberation around what was the right thing to do and how should a media outlet act. And in a sense, that's what has always set these, you know, kind of broadcasters apart,
mm-hmm.
is that it's a very different kind of media. It's a very different kind of broadcasting and a very different kind of communication than what most people are aware of. And sadly, I think when people, a lot of people will just listen to the station as a form of entertainment or a form of news and not necessarily understand the significance of some of those processes that are operating in behind. But
yeah. Thank you for sharing that. That's really intense. Louise didn't explain that to me at all.
Oh, it was, those were, they were very, very exciting, And very, very traumatic days, you know, and it was back in a time when, you know, particularly I think for gay people, that, we were fighting a war and, so many people died. Mm-hmm. You know, I have trouble sometimes thinking back on that time because so many people died.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people that were close to the station, that were close to people who were at the station, you know, Don Rossiter died of HIV, AIDS then. So many people who were supporters of the station, who were involved with things. And it was it's a really, really horrible time. But in that time, people fighting that good fight, relationships are made and communities are made. And that's where, you know, Montreal's gay pride came from. It came from those Sex Garage events. And at the end of that month of protest after that event was a big sort of public celebration. And that's what became Montreal's gay pride.
Yeah, that's very
and,
inspiring.
You know, for somebody of my age, I mean, at that time, you think back around, you know, a fight for rights, and a fight for acknowledgement, and a fight to change social perceptions and social norms. You know, you look back 30 years and you think, well, the situation that existed then and the situation that exists now for gay people, I mean, not very many people, I think, can say that they've seen the kind of changes in their own lifetime that you would want to. Maybe some, but, you know, pretty profound changes in this country in terms of not just the laws and the legal frameworks, but also people's perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
This is an incredibly gay-friendly country. Now, I think there's still a lot of work to be done, and there are always new frontiers to fight on. And but, you know, this has been a remarkable amount of change. So when you look back on how difficult those times were and you think today, well, everybody who made sacrifices.
Okay. I have no more written questions for you. Do you have anything you want to say at the end of our interview here?
I just, you know, I think, you know, CKUT, such a remarkable place, you know, really. And it really does deserve to be celebrated, you know, both what it was and what it is now. I have a son in Montreal who's now just turned 16. And the fact that my 16-year-old son thinks that CKUT is somehow the coolest thing ever says an awful lot to me about the station and how it really hasn't, you know, in a sense, I think I'm sure it's changed a lot and I'm sure it's changed for the better. But I'm sure that some of those things that are really at the core of it probably haven't changed very much at all. It's a pretty remarkable place. It's certainly unique amongst all the radio stations that I know, and any interactions or things that I hear about it, you know, in the years that followed have made me think that a lot of the spirit that was present in the days when I was there is still very much alive and well, which is nice to know.
Mm-hmm. I got hired in October. And some of the things that you were saying about we got to be on the cutting edge, those were some of the things that were literally said to me during my like training process.
Right. Great.
So, great. Yeah, we still try pretty hard.